I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Our topic today is inclusiveness, and our guests have found very different ways to bring the world together. First, we'll speak with Matt Harding. His original viral video, Where the Hell is Matt, has him dancing in far-flung locations. He's just released a new video where Matt dances with people from all over the world. And we'll speak with Daniel Isofano and Susan Goldsman, who've written a new book called The Inclusive City, Design Solutions for Building Neighborhoods and Urban Spaces, that describes how city planners, developers, and residents can create space together. Plus, we'll hear from our regular commentators, Walker Smith and Nate Berg, right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. You've probably seen our first guest on YouTube. A friend or a coworker might have emailed you a link to this mega popular video, Where the Hell is Matt? If you clicked on that link, you've seen a man in his late 20s, joyously, some might say badly, dancing in front of landmarks from all over the world. It's just fun. That man is our guest, Matt Harding, who turned a six-month sabbatical from work into a viral video sensation. Matt, what's made your video dancing such a hit on YouTube?
That's a tough question. It's a bit unquantifiable. I think the universality of it, it's something that everyone can relate to and everyone does, most everyone, which is dance.
And where did the idea of dancing originate? And what was the impulse?
Well, the idea of me dancing, I've just always done that dance. I did it for years at my job to annoy my coworkers. When it was time to go to lunch, I'd kind of hover over everybody's desk and do that dance until they got up and came with me to get lunch. I was really much more interested in going out and taking a break than actually working at my job, which coincidentally, a couple of years into it, I decided to take off and start traveling. This was in Australia, Brisbane, Australia, and I was working as a video game designer. I just sort of stuck my head up from the cubicle and realized I needed a break and I needed to be doing something else, and travel was something that I was very interested in. So I took that money that I'd saved up in my job and did this big six-month trip around the world in 2003. And that was my first real leap into international travel. And I discovered it was something that I was good at and enjoyed a great deal.
You were good at the travel.
Yeah, I wasn't so good at my job, but I was good at not working and just wandering around the planet.
Okay, so this dance that you did to get people to go to lunch and to, you know, show them you're ready. How did you put, you know, these two things together? Travel, Matt in front of major landmarks doing this dance.
Well, I didn't make that leap myself. That was a friend of mine, Brad Welch, who I used to work with, and he actually took my job when I left. But he also came traveling with me for a week, and we were in Hanoi in Vietnam. He met up with me, and we were just taking pictures of street scenes, and he said, "Why don't you stand over there and do that stupid dance you used to do?" And so I stood on a curb as Vietnamese motorbikes were passing by us, and I just started doing the dance, and he shot it, and I liked it. It was a nice way to take a memento from each place that I went to. And, you know, you don't have to carry around a stuffed animal or a T-shirt like a lot of people do when they take those mementos. It was just something I could always do anywhere. And it was at a time when digital cameras were proliferating. So suddenly everybody has a digital camera in their pocket, and they all have video functions. So it was very easy to suddenly shoot video anywhere.
You didn't want a collection of shot glasses from all the places you'd visited?
You know, it can be hard to find a shot glass in Zambia.
Well, let me ask you this. Did you, once the idea occurred to your friend and he shot you on video in Hanoi doing this dance, did you then subsequently do it at every place? I mean, did the idea occur to you then as, oh, big idea, let's keep doing this. This will be my mark, my signature. Or did it take a while for you to figure out that this is something I should do all the time?
Well, I knew right away that it was something that it would be fun to collect as I was traveling. It was not a big idea. It was a very, very small idea. I had this trip planned. I was traveling around Southeast Asia and taking the Trans-Siberian from Beijing to Moscow, which got derailed, no pun intended, when SARS hit. That was in 2003, so I couldn't take the train through China. But in any case, it was I was going to all these places, and I just thought, oh, this will be a nice way for me to remember each place that I really enjoyed. It wasn't until about a year and a half later that I put it on the internet and discovered that something that was amusing to me and I thought would be amusing to a few of my friends was amusing to a much larger number of people.
And the larger number of people now includes how many?
Somewhere over 20 million, I would say.
How has that changed your life?
It has changed my life every single day. It's absolutely a part of my life. It's my job. I've been doing it for a few years now, this bad dancing thing. It's not to the point where I get recognized walking down the street, fortunately. It's exactly the right amount of notoriety because I can mention it at a party and people will say, oh, I've heard about that thing. But it's not if I don't want anyone to know about it. I just simply don't have to mention it. So that works well.
If you go into a dance club, do you start into this particular kind of dance or do you sit back and watch the others?
Well, that does not happen very often. First of all, I don't end up in dance clubs very often. And when I do, I would not be fool enough to do that kind of dance on a dance floor. It's reserved for exotic locations.
How many cities have you now taped yourself dancing in? Wow. Wow. Most interesting place you've been?
That is a tough one. I'm not good at favorites and mosts, but there are certainly quite a few memorable ones on this.
Which is the one that if they said, pack your bags, you can leave tonight and return to, which one would it be?
Well, one place that really stuck in my head from this last trip, the last 14-month trip around the world, was Bhutan. That's just a really remarkable and unique place. My favorite places to go to are the ones where I have no idea what to expect, that are just absolute mysteries. And that was something that I'd heard very little about. And learning about it while I was there was just fascinating. It's They're a monarchy. They're the youngest monarchy in the world. And the king of Bhutan decided, I think in the 1970s, that instead of gauging their prosperity in economic terms the way the whole rest of the world was doing and continues to do, they were going to gauge it on happiness. He has this term, gross national happiness. And so all of their policies, and they even have a ministry of happiness, they make decisions for their people based on what is best for their quality of life. And it's just a refreshing way of looking at things that you really do see the impact of it as you travel around the country. And I thought that was fascinating.
When you travel, how central is the need to videotape your dancing? Do you plan around that, or is that now sort of ancillary to really seeing the country and understanding what's going on there?
It's changed over the years because 5 years ago it was certainly incidental. I was going on the trip anyway, and it was something that I was doing. It became a means to an end when the video became popular on the internet in 2005 and started getting a couple million views. And I had a sponsor come along, Stride Gum, and they said, how would you like to keep on doing this? How would you like to keep on making videos? And I said, absolutely. So in 2006, that trip was the first one that was really about making a video. After I made the first video, which I said was just sort of a goof, and people started watching it, I got frustrated because I thought I could have made that so much better. If I'd really thought about it, if I'd known what I was doing, I could have made a much better video. So I had an opportunity to. And it really was a project to a degree. It was sort of the halfway point where I was having an opportunity to go to Antarctica and Easter Island and Galapagos and these places that I'm absolutely genuinely fascinated about. But that said, I always had a mission in each place I went, which was to get this dancing clip. And I actually really enjoyed traveling with the mission. I think that's the best way. You should always have a whatever it is. It can be completely arbitrary, but a thing that you're doing that is your goal, because I think that your experiences tend to take shape around that, and you often will have encounters with people, a level of involvement and intimacy that you wouldn't have if, when you're just wandering around. No, there's nothing bad about wandering around aimlessly. That's fine too, and I enjoy doing that, but I often have more engaged experiences when I am trying to get something. And so the dancing, yeah, I'm always trying to get a clip.
Well, what sort of production is it to get yourself on tape dancing in front of landmark sites, often in the company of crowds of locals?
What sort of production is it? Well, it varies, and that's also changed over the years, especially on this last video, which was necessarily a much bigger undertaking, because when I started this third one in 2007, the video had been seen by over 10 million people and the previous videos, and it was sort of a victory lap where people now had seen it, people knew it, and I'd gotten thousands of emails from people who wanted me to come to their country and dance with them. So the third video was really about taking people up on that and using the power of the internet to contact all of them and say, hey, I'm coming to Brussels, Belgium. I'm going to be in this place at this time. Come out and dance with me. And every single time we did it, they did. My girlfriend Melissa, she helped put this all together. She dealt with the logistics of figuring out the places and making sure we could dance there and contacting all the people. She produced the video with me. But it's become a real exercise in organized chaos, getting all these random people to show up. And it's not like they're extras. It's not like they've been hired to dance. They just show up, and they don't entirely know what to expect. I think they expect me to show up in a limo with Stride gum handlers all around me, but it's me in a backpack and sometimes my girlfriend holding the camera. And yeah, getting everybody to stand in the right place and dance on cue is a lot of fun, but it requires some preparation.
So it is still fun.
It's loads of fun. And if I were still dancing in front of landmarks, if I were going to the Parthenon and the Great Wall of China and shooting the postcard images, I think it would have gotten a little bit stale. But this third video, I'm so glad it evolved into this thing of dancing with other people, because that's what keeps, I mean, I'm able to sort of feed off of their energy, I think probably in a way that live musicians do. Like the Rolling Stones have been playing the same songs for 45 years, but I think when they do it in front of an audience and they have everyone else's excitement, it becomes fresh and new. So I did this in 45 cities on 6 continents. We'd organize these events, and every single time people showed up, and every single time it was a blast.
What have you learned from all of this?
Well, I always think of it in terms of the external and the internal. Externally, I learned a lot about the world, to the point where listening to the news, listening to BBC World and things like that, I'm familiar with almost every place that gets brought up. And it's not just a blob on the map where I could care less about what happens. It's places that are familiar. And when I hear the names of countries, I think of faces and people that I've met, as opposed to just the geography. And so that's, I think, made me a much more connected to the larger world, which is a bit overwhelming, but I think really important for everyone to do. And then internally, I think even more importantly, it's changed my sense of self and what I'm capable of, because I think you don't really learn what you are capable of until you're thrown into a situation that is really outside of your comfort zone, and you have to sort your own way through it. And travel's not the only way to do that, but it was the way that I did that. I found myself in situations where I just thought, you know, I'm going to have to step up and figure out how to get out of this out of this country that I need to get out of, or catch this plane that I've missed, you know. Those sorts of situations that happen when you do really kind of intrepid international travel.
Is Stride Gum still on board for another tour?
I have no idea. We haven't talked about it. I don't want to think about another trip yet. I just finished a month ago. I just did 46 countries in a little over a year. So I am thrilled to be home, sitting on the couch, recuperating, and plan to keep doing that for a while and then maybe start thinking about another one at some point, or maybe not.
And if not, then what has this prepared you to do? I mean, what do you think about for the future?
I don't worry about the future too much, and I don't think about it too much. I'm really enjoying what's going on, and I'm really proud of the work, which sounds silly because it's just me dancing badly in all these places, but I the response from people has been surprising and moving. People respond in a very powerful way to something that is very simple and joyful, and that reminds them that people are essentially good. And I think people want very much to be reminded of that. And strangely enough, just seeing people all over the planet being ridiculous, it triggers that feeling for people. So I'm just sort of basking in the satisfaction of having done something that's made people feel really good.
Have you, has it made you look at dance, organized dance, formal dance, ballet, modern, contemporary dance in any new ways?
I think all forms of dance are wonderful. I'm not a dancer. I don't know how to do any kind of dance other than the one really silly one that I do. It's not something that I've ever studied or made a part of my life, but I do recognize that it's something that we all enjoy doing. It's sort of a fundamental thing that we all have these bodies and we like flailing them around. I think some people do it in more refined, prepared ways than I do, but I think it's all the same, essentially. It's fun.
And what would you recommend? I'm just curious, what would you recommend to someone who wanted to emulate your success? Are there things that you could say, do this, don't do that, or do you feel like in some ways it was purely accidental?
Well, I think it being accidental is an important part of it. I think particularly on internet video, there's a distinction in my mind between the ephemeral things, the just sort of the authentic, sincere moments, and the things that are deliberate marketing exercises. I think people can tell. I think it's really important to just do something that is new, that people haven't seen before, and keep it simple.
Matt, thanks for talking with us on Smart City today.
Thank you very much.
If you'd like to see Matt's happy feet in action, we have a link to the videos from our website, smartcityradio.com. And for the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Plan Edison assistant editor, Nate Berg.
Housing may be the biggest issue facing America in this election year. The subprime mortgage fiasco has left thousands deep in debt and without homes. The Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development should be just the agency to do something about the mess, but many say it's done little, if anything, and it may be time for HUD to go. In a recent op-ed in the New York Times, Columbia University professor Sudhir Venkatesh argues that HUD's model of providing housing is based on an urban growth pattern that's no longer relevant. He says HUD works best with distinct cities that are separate from one another. But as urbanization continues, these distinct areas are melding together, creating metropolitan regions of immense size. He says HUD's days should be numbered and that the struggling department should be replaced with one better able to adapt to the new forms of our cities and regions. And while housing remains a major concern and problem in America, rising gas prices are also causing dismay across the country. This is especially true in small-town America. A recent article in the Kansas City Star looks at how rising gas prices are causing many small-town residents to consider swapping their far-flung residence for housing that's closer to work. Economists are predicting that the next few years will bring a grand exodus of people from small-town America, creating ghost towns throughout the country. And though small towns have experienced population decline in the past as farming and factory work trickled away, the new shift out of small towns is less an effect of the changing economy than a symptom of a completely new way of life. And finally, you probably think you know poor when you see it, but looks can be deceiving. A new report has found that many of the economically depressed areas we might look at as being poor actually have some pretty significant economic potential. The findings from the Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit Social Compact reveal that there are literally billions of dollars to be made in the lower-income neighborhoods businesses are typically hesitant to approach. Bank branches and grocery stores are prime candidates for locating in these areas, which boast large populations and a surprising amount of discretionary income. According to a recent segment on National Public Radio, census figures for these areas tend to undercut the actual populations, meaning that the area incomes are actually much higher than the data would let on. Tapping into this unlikely wealth could be a major investment opportunity for businesses. And more importantly, a critical move towards building sustainable communities. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen.com. Coming up after this short break, we'll speak with Dan Isofano and Susan Goldsman. They've written a new book that challenges city planners to think beyond the bricks and mortar of their sites. Coming up on Smart City Radio, I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Urban planning has its fads, fashions, and styles. Since the late 1980s, the trend has been new urbanism. The philosophy of new urbanism promotes neighborhoods and walkability as opposed to suburban sprawl and car culture. But what's to come after new urbanism? Our guests, Daniel Isofano and Susan Goldsman, have one answer. They've written a book called The Inclusive City, Design Solutions for Buildings, Neighborhoods, and Urban Spaces. In it, they say it's time to take the lessons learned from new urbanism and think about more than just the bricks and mortar when developing our cities. Daniel and Susan are very busy people, but we managed to get them in their offices in Fullerton, California. The recording is a little difficult to hear at times, but their insights are valuable, and we're excited to bring you this interview. In your book, The Inclusive City, you seem both to applaud new urbanism and to criticize it. Why are you critical?
We applaud new urbanism in that it clearly represents a new direction and a field innovation that we hardly endorse. But we say it doesn't go far enough. And if you look at the operative term there, people in new urbanism talk about form-based zoning. The emphasis is on form. And we care about not only the form, but also what's behind the form. In other words, the people in the buildings. Are they receiving a environment that meets their functional day-to-day needs? Do they have access to clean air, parks, open space, schools? Do they have living wage jobs? So our view of the inclusive city has to embrace the social, the economic, and the cultural environment, as well as the physical.
And how do you do that through the tools we have available?
Well, that's where we look at the policies of the city and not just the physical zoning or land use requirements and regulations. So programmatically, in the case of economic development or opportunities, we might have an emphasis on local first hires, where if a new business is locating in a community, they set aside resources to help the community colleges develop training programs so local community members and residents can get access to the jobs that are being created. So that's an example of a collateral program. In the case of parks or recreation, there has to be programming available for children and young people and families so that they have access to the kinds of services they need. So it isn't just providing physical space and the people with access to the parks within a quarter or half a mile of where they live, but it's having the activities there that are really going to activate and engage the children.
Let's talk about who we're trying to provide direction to. Form-based codes, as an example, provide direction both to city officials and they provide direction to developers. I mean, at what point are developers really out of the equation? You talk about, for instance, in economic development, local first hires. With parks, you talk about programming, that it's not enough to provide a park. It's important to provide programming. So who are you providing guidance to with these kinds of policy frameworks other than city officials?
Well, I think you're providing it to the whole entire community. It's to the designers, it's to the developers, it's to the officials, it's also to the citizens. Because a lot of these case studies that we have in the book are really citizen-driven. In the case of providing a space, space doesn't come by itself. And the way in which our society has divided up responsibility in the community, the different disciplines take on different roles. But space is the container of the whole social fabric of the environment that we live in. And if we don't deal with everything that this container is supposed to hold, we haven't done our job. So it's really a community process.
When you say inclusive design, what do you mean?
Right. Well, we define three criteria for inclusive design. We talk about functionality as criteria number one, meaning that the environment meets the needs of the user. Kevin Lynch, our very famous city planner from the 50s and 60s, and then later in his book on Theory of Good City Form, talked about function and fit, meeting the needs of the human being. The second is context sensitivity, where the development is not an island, but it's integrated and connected to the surrounding environment by bicycle, pedestrian, public transit, and other kinds of networks. And that's also in an ecological sense as well as in a physical design sense. And the third and possibly most important criteria is that a project must have equitable impact, meaning that the positive and negative impacts or implications of a project must not fall disproportionately on any one group or segment of society, that you have opportunities for people to gain equity positions, that they have an opportunity to gain equity or to build their capability, and not just for development targeted for an exclusive elite.
And when you say build equity, what form would that take?
It could take all different kinds. Here's a project that I'm working with in the city of North Las Vegas, and it's very interesting. They're proposing a Mercado, which they have built in other locations. And this developer has said, well, one of the large 80,000 square foot shed structures in this marketplace is going to be for small shop owners and stalls and individual citizens to have their own little retail operations, like 50 square feet or 100 square feet. And by carving up the space in that way, they are actually providing opportunities to gain a foothold and to be their own self-employed individual. That's an example of providing equity.
There's other ways of providing equity too. If you're looking at, let's say, children and families, if you look at a whole entire system of how you're providing spaces for different kinds of play opportunities for children 0 to 18 years old and their families throughout the city, how do you begin to equitably distribute that kind of land use throughout the city so everybody has something within a 5-minute walk of their house? And you have to start doing this in a way that really gets to look at clusters of activity around the city and where the kids are located, where the families are located, and where these things should be so they're equitably distributed. This has to do with government policy, but it also has to do with, when you just put your park systems together or renovate your park systems, where you lay out your land, and then how you actually fund these things. And you actually fund them through the developer, because the developer is the one that's making most of the money in the city, and through fees and different ways in which the developer has to give back to be able to make the money for a city, you can actually begin to redistribute this kind of thing throughout the whole city and create a more equitable distribution of resources.
Maybe one more concrete example would be the need to address the negative or deleterious effects of large infrastructure on neighborhoods and communities. So you have something like in the city of San Francisco, Octavia Boulevard, which used to be the central freeway, an elevated structure that bisected neighborhoods. It created a major barrier and created unsafe spaces for people to hide and prey on others. And so what they decided to do was to tear down that structure in the wake of the Loma Prieta earthquake of 1989. And basically rebuild it as a multi-way boulevard surface street, which created more park space, more safe space for bicycles and pedestrians. And the same volume of cars go down there, but it goes down in a slower fashion and in a way that allows these other modes of travel to operate. So by singling out that type of project and prioritizing that in the capital improvement program, you have an example of making a regional infrastructure project much more equitable for the people living near and adjacent to that facility.
You're listening to Smart City, and our guests are Daniel Isofano and Susan Goldsman. They are authors of The Inclusive City, Design Solutions for Buildings, Neighborhoods, and Urban Spaces. In the broad policy framework that you propose to help guide urban decision making, You include a couple of things that I want to follow up on, because I think no one would disagree with the policy as you write it. But my question would be its execution or implementation. You write that we need to provide opportunities for everyone to participate fully in the economy of the city with access to a variety of jobs. What new insights can you offer up to achieving that ambitious goal?
Well, we talked about the idea of local first hires. That's not our idea or innovation. That is something that's been promulgated by cities for the last 10 or more years. And that's one example of that idea. And so having the community colleges, for example, who are often in the business of providing workforce training for individuals to step up and get quality or living wage jobs, the cities need to work closely with them to give them the information about the kinds of economic development opportunities that are being forecast in that city. So you have the economists who do cluster analysis determining that certain areas of the community are likely to experience job growth, whether it be in shipping or logistics or in green industries or sustainable development, those types of things that people are forecasting some job growth, then the cities have a responsibility to bring that information to the community college system and help them align their programs accordingly. And then they can also create other incentives for the developers of these larger scale projects to work in concert with the community colleges. So that's an example of how we see taking this idea forward. It's essentially connecting one institution of the community with another instead of everyone operating according to separate islands.
Which is a challenge in every community, to get institutions working together. And these institutions don't have the same constituents. They don't have the same owners, if you will, or they're serving different masters. So I'm curious if you've seen communities in which you felt this coordination that you're calling for is well done.
Well, I think what we're calling for is not necessarily economic development or any one of these things. We're talking about getting people involved in a meaningful way in the decisions that are affecting their daily lives, and the physical environment is the container of all those aspects of their lives. And so getting people involved in ways in which they can begin to talk to each other and having people listen to that and actually build programs around what they're hearing and doing to begin that kind of discussion for all people in the community, not just those who can afford it or those who attend meetings.
Right. And how do you do that? I mean, all of us have, I've talked about this on the show many times, all of us have attended our fair share of public meetings, and as you say, they are limited to those who can indeed attend, and that doesn't just mean, you know, poor people who don't have a way to get there. It can also mean busy people who, you know, simply can't, they travel, they can't find time in their schedule to attend interminable public meetings to get, you know, the one word out that they want to say. It's the whole public participation process. It can be extraordinarily frustrating. How do we bring new meaning and efficiency to that process in a way that really engages people in a productive discussion?
There are some examples that we are participating in out here on the West Coast. For example, the I-710 freeway is the main artery that connects the ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles into the Alameda Corridor, which is the super train that carries all those goods from the Pacific Rim into the center of North America. And that 710 freeway is hugely congested with trucks of all sizes. It essentially forms a toxic cloud over that facility, and it extends broadly over to the adjacent communities. And so in the planning for the possible expansion of that facility, the Department of Highways and Transportation, or known as Caltrans in the state of California, started to proceed with that in the normal way, but the communities banded together in a series of coalitions and committees representing the different cities along this corridor. And they also insisted that this had to be looked at not only as a transportation problem, but as a public health problem. And so they brought in the Department of Public Health, and they brought in the transportation authority that deals with mass transit and those other agencies. So it's a multi-jurisdictional and multi-agency planning effort, and there are legislators and other local elected officials that have signed on to this and said they are committed and using their political capital, as it were, to ensure that these community imperatives are followed through. So it requires a commitment at the highest level and also at the local regional levels in order to make something like this successful.
Actually, the plan that has emerged from it is a direct result of the community coming up with an alternative plan that actually works better than what the professionals came up with. So it's actually getting the people to be heard, but actually allowing them to put forth what they know in a way that makes it effective with the politicians.
And Susan, in that case that you're speaking of, who represented or facilitated or assisted citizens in developing an alternative?
Well, our company, MIG, was a major component to that, but we have a very large technical team. It includes the staff of the Gateway Council of Governments, who are the ones that hired us and essentially established the parameters for which this process would be conducted. And then the other agencies and jurisdictions signed on to this sort of collaborative process plan and rules of engagement that ensured that these public issues and community issues would be aired and not just written down or documented, but actually would be acted upon as a basis for doing anything about the project. So we have a lot of examples of how that process can be carried out.
I was just reading a document last night from, it's a new document from IBM. It was quite interesting in its elevation of this notion of collaboration and how that is, of course, becoming the new way of operating to get so many things done, whether you're talking about innovation or whether you're talking about politics, political campaigns anyway, getting someone elected. And yet I don't often see it done very well in public process. And so it's great to learn of examples where it is being used effectively. That's a good thing to know. Let me ask you this. I want to go back to your principles for a minute, your policy framework. I was very interested in your notion of cultural meaning as one of the policies to guide development and the inclusive city. Let me ask you how you achieve cultural meaning in places that are culturally diverse.
That's the exciting part, because when you have a culturally diverse group, you have many cultures coming together to actually enrich the environment you're in. Let me give you a very clear example of this. We were doing a model project in Glendale, California, where we were going to take an entire block, and the community was Armenian, Spanish, and Caucasian. And the whole block to put in a new school. It'd be a 24/7 school. It'd be a recreation center. It would be a police substation. It'd be a park, and it'd be a library and a senior center. And the first time we brought everybody together, there was a lot of controversy from the different groups and how they didn't get along so well, and everybody had issues, and there was a lot of graffiti in the neighborhood, and so there was a lot of those kind of issues. And one of the first things that we did with the group is we had everybody bring pictures of their families from the countries they came from. And everybody brought these wonderful pictures, and we put them up on a wall. And all of a sudden, you couldn't see the difference between one grandmother and another grandmother. And you had this huge collage of all these pictures of these families that we all have, and the different fabrics that they were wearing, and how each one of them brought something rich to this particular environment. And that began the process of everybody trying to get to know each other on a more personal level so you could do something together as a community. And what happened when that school got built, the whole fabric of the wall on the outside wall of the school, which was concrete, was enriched and embossed with all the fabrics from those original photographs. And it became a symbol of how everybody can work together when you really take the time to get to know each other. And that's what it's about. It's not about these amorphous policies. This stuff takes time. It takes caring. It takes people-to-people interaction. It takes communication.
And actually, another example we'd like to offer is in the city of Richmond, California, where we're currently engaged in developing a new comprehensive plan for the city, looking 20 or more years into the future. This community is extremely diverse. There's equal parts African-American, Caucasian, Asian, Latino, and they really celebrate that richness and that diversity, and they are there because of it. And one of the innovations, the city staff decided to obtain a grant and seek funding for artists in the community to come together and actually paint a special program of comprehensive plan art, city planning art, which we're going to feature in the new document. But it, in its very clear and very dramatic ways, expresses a lot of the commonalities among peoples of different cultures, and the fact that they do also bring uniqueness there, and that's going to be reflected in something as abstract and conceptual as the policy document for the city.
And in fact, when you go to cities that you really, really like and you find them interesting, it's because of the cultural diversity. So let's say you're going to New York City. The parts that are most interesting are the Village. When you walk around Soho, when you walk around Chinatown, when you walk around Little Italy, you begin to, that richness comes across, and that becomes, it becomes an economic development tool if you really think about it, because you don't want every place in the world to be the same. So if your physical environment started to express who you were of that place, it becomes a special place. It's not a stamped out McDonald's on every single corner. It's a different kind of environment that is reflective of the people who live there, and it becomes a very, very, an economic driver for the city and a quality of life issue.
Susan, let me just press that point 1 minute, because I think you're certainly right when you walk through Little Italy or Chinatown and it is readily identifiable with a particular ethnic group. And yet, if you are not Chinese, if you are not Italian, trying to live in those neighborhoods can be uncomfortable. You can feel like an outsider because the neighborhood is so clearly identified with a particular ethnic group. And I think while those are fabulous and wonderful for cities, I think, you know, certainly the more troublesome question is the example you gave earlier. How do you make a neighborhood in which Spanish and Armenian and Caucasians are all living together, sharing a school, sharing space, sharing restaurants in a way that no one feels left out or alien?
Well, you know, we live in Berkeley. So Berkeley is that kind of multicultural community. We have every kind of nationality and ethnicity in the city of Berkeley. There must be 150 different languages spoken there. And there's places like L.A. that have that. There's places like Pasadena that have, when you go to their new downtowns and you see that it has different kind of restaurants and different kind of opportunities for people of all different kinds of backgrounds to feel comfortable there. You don't have to go to Chinatown. You don't have to go to a Little Italy. You can go to a lot of other places that are beginning to have that kind of feel. There's a place in Oakland that was developed around a BART station. It's called the Fruitvale area. It is a multicultural area, and instead of high-rise and big development that went around this BART station, the community got together through the Spanish Unity Council, And they organized the whole entire community to put the kind of goods and services that are needed by the BART station for the people who live in that community. It's a very diverse community. And it's beginning to be reflective. So on Saturday morning when you go to the farmers market, you see a whole range of people around the BART station that live in that community, that work in their community. There's a child care center there for the kids of the community. There's a senior center where people go, and it represents all different kinds of backgrounds of people who are becoming part of this BART area development. There's two new schools there that represent that kind of diversity as well. So it is happening in places all around the different parts of the United States. It's just not happening enough in enough depth that it's easy for people to point to and say this is the way it should be. And it has to grow out of the local community. It has to grow out of this interaction among people. That's how we used to develop our cities. And now we develop them where we have a very a large group of very well-financed developers coming in and taking massive blocks of areas and putting up these very beautiful places that a lot of people can't afford to live in or buy the goods and services that are there.
Well, Susan and Dan, I want to thank you for being our guest on Smart City today.
Well, thank you very much, Carol. We appreciate having the opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you very much.
Daniel Isofano and Susan Goldsman are principals at the firm Moore Isofano and Goldsman. Their new book is called The Inclusive City: Design Solutions for Buildings, Neighborhoods, and Urban Spaces. The interview was engineered by David Knight. Walker Smith has been spending time online lately, but in all sorts of different ways. He says the internet is not just changing how we live, but also where we live.
All the new media buzz nowadays is about technology. This is no surprise, really. The whiz-bang gadgetry of the new media landscape is utterly extraordinary, so it's well-deserving of all the attention. But when we quit gawking and look more closely, we see the coming of something much more important than the eye-popping wizardry of widgets, wireless, and Wi-Fi. It's a growing shift in where we use media, not just a shift in what we can do with the media at hand. In other words, something under our control, place, becomes just as important, if not more important, than all the technological gizmos that are the province of high-tech engineers. Take video, for example. For decades, video consumption was pretty much limited to a TV at home or the local movie theater. While we could also catch a movie on a plane or watch a ball game at a sports bar, video media were highly place-specific. No more. These days, video is everywhere, largely, though not entirely, because it is now portable. Our cars come equipped with video players. iPods put movies, TV shows, and even videos of college lectures in our pockets. With our cell phones, we can surf the web over to YouTube to see today's hot video. Cable TV blares at us in airports, elevators, and shopping malls. Some airplanes have been retrofitted to show live TV broadcast. And a few retailers air proprietary video programming in their stores. We can even embed video in our email and PowerPoint presentations. This kind of situational ubiquity is not unique to video. It is true of all media nowadays. This makes situation a bigger and often dominant factor in how media work nowadays. I realize that this sounds like an obscure point, but in fact it is something that matters dearly to us. Much of how we live our lives is determined by the places where we consume media. Consider the differences between watching a TV show at home versus watching the same show in an airport lounge or on an iPod or on YouTube. Viewing with family members is much more likely to happen in the comfortable, familiar, intimate environment of home. An airport lounge is a busy, crowded place filled with strangers and distractions. An iPod is usually a solitary experience, as is YouTube, although internet viewing may involve online interaction or even online multitasking. In every situation, it's the same content, creative, and characteristics. Only the situations differ. And these differences have dramatic effects on the power of the video to command our attention and change our opinions. What differs now is our ability to pick our place. In fact, the growing importance of situation puts us in more control of the media we use. Marketers can change the content or the medium itself, but choice of place is ours. When media are untethered from any one place in particular, the choice of place becomes ours. We are free to pick a place best suited for our own purposes. And in yet one more way, if we will but act upon it, we acquire more autonomy and control over our lives. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his latest book is Generation Ageless. You can find our website, smartcityradio.com, from your iPhone, your BlackBerry, or your good old-fashioned computer. While you're there, you can listen to archive shows, sign up for our weekly newsletter, or subscribe to our podcast. Most importantly, you can get in touch with us and let us know how we're doing. Click on the contact button or email us at questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our well-rested producer and engineer just back from vacation. I'm Carol Coletta.